This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
We knew the world would not be the same. I remembered the line from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita. Now I am become death, the destroyer of worlds. I suppose we all thought that one way or another.
Not able to bring back some bodies inside the evacuation zone because they are just too radioactive.
It's up to the individual member of public to consider how concerned he or she may be, and it's not up for scientists in white coats to make that decision for them.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, where we are all more radioactive. It is almost a month since the multiple nuclear disasters in Japan, and still, we hardly know what to expect. Last week, the International Atomic Energy Agency assured the world there would be no further explosions. Today, the Los Angeles Times reports, quote, engineers also plan to begin injecting nitrogen gas into reactor numbers 1, 2, and 3 in an attempt to prevent possible explosions from the buildup of hydrogen gas. We have reports of meltdowns in reactors and possibly spent fuel pools. You will hear two nuclear experts with different points of view. Dr. John Large from the UK explains the ongoing disaster. Then Dr. Christoph Starosta from Canada reports radiation from Fukushima reactors has reached the rain and seaweed in Vancouver, but it's no problem. I've got 80 minutes of audio for a one-hour program, so we might as well let the recordings speak for themselves and you be the judge. Fear and controversy are the children of the atom.
If somehow a product could be atomic, it had to be good. Including
the family car, which are now being developed with atomic energy. Even your toothpaste may be a product of the atomic age.
The biggest development of the week, Japan unilaterally decided to dump thousands of tons of radioactive waste into the Pacific Ocean, and that's on top of the existing leak of highly radioactive waste coming from Fukushima Reactor No. 2. Here's a report from Mark Willacy of ABC TV Australia.
This pooling of water around the reactor, around the plant, that's not going to happen. And we've heard from the government overnight that it's going to take months for that cooling system to come back online. And that means that we are going to have to dump thousands of tons of water over these fuel rods every day until that cooling system's back online.
And already there are reports of radioactive leaks into the ocean. How serious is that?
It's extremely serious. What we have is a 20-centimetre long crack inside a concrete pit near Reactor 2. Now, that's letting out 7,000 tonnes of radioactive water every hour. And this is quite highly radioactive water. This isn't low-level radiation. Now, what they've tried to do is to try and plug that crack. They've tried to put concrete in it, but the force of the water has just blown the concrete out. The crack's still there. Then they tried something even more ingenious, they thought, and that was mixing sawdust with shredded newspaper and what's called an absorbent polymer. This polymer apparently can absorb water 50 times its size, but unfortunately, that didn't work either. That was simply blown out by the force of the water. So there's still this 20-centimetre crack in this concrete trench, this pit, and that is leaching thousands of tonnes of water, radioactive water, into the Pacific every hour.
But there are also reports, not just, I guess, of leaks and leaching, but also that the authorities, the operators, may have to actually dump contaminated water.
Well, I can tell you that started a short time ago. There's going to be an 11,500 tonnes of what's being called low-level radioactive water dumped into the Pacific. Now, the reason this has to be done, according to TEPCO, the company that operates the plant, and the government here in Tokyo, is because this water is just building up around the plant. As I said, 11,500 tonnes of it, it's not going anywhere. It has to be moved out of the way so that really contaminated and toxic radioactive water can be stored safely at the plant and not run off into the ocean. So that dumping process has started tonight. That will continue on. Now, TEPCO, the operator, and the government are assuring the Japanese public that there is nothing to fear from this water. They're saying it's low level, and you could actually eat seafood that was caught in this water every day for a year, and apparently you'd only have a quarter of your annual environmental radiation exposure. So in other words, the government and TEPCO are saying, please, do not panic. This is low-level radioactive water. We have to do this so that the highly contaminated water doesn't leach outside the plant.
I wonder, though, how many will be prepared to take that risk. Mark Willesey, many thanks.
Again, from the Australian National Broadcaster, we get protests from both Greenpeace and Friends of Earth.
The move has drawn outrage and condemnation from around the world.
So there's evidence from Europe that radioactive releases into the sea will damage the seafood, like shellfish and seaweed, which will be contaminated, and beaches will be highly contaminated as well.
Thomas Brewer is heading up the Greenpeace presence in Japan.
The information about the desperateness on the nuclear power plant is so bad that we don't know whether it is necessary to release the water or not.
Other conservation organisations say there is no justification for deliberate ocean dumping. The Friends of the Earth described the move as exporting Japan's burden to the world.
We're really in a disastrous situation in Japan. There are only bad choices at this point. We really do face a situation in which we could have further explosions and fires at the reactors in the nuclear waste site, and they do indeed need to cool it down. But that can't possibly be a justification.
The organization's Damon Moglen has been working on nuclear issues for 25 years. He says dumping radioactive waste at sea is forbidden under an international treaty called the London Convention. Japan, the US and Australia are all signatories to the treaty, but he says it doesn't cover release of radioactive material from land.
This is really a landmark international agreement, and yet, in this case, the Japanese government and industry are using a loophole which says that while you can't dump nuclear waste directly into the ocean in barrels, for example, you can actually pump it into the ocean from land-based sources.
The Friends of the Earth are calling for the waste to instead be moved into storage tankers at sea or into tanks on land. They're calling for the US government to urgently step in to prevent the deliberate waste dumping.
Adrian Francis reporting.
Following announcements on Japanese TV, the American Secretary of Energy, Stephen Chu, said reactor number one was 70% destroyed. And new aerial footage certainly backs that up. Nobody is going to restore the original cooling system from what I can see in the wreckage. A former U.S. nuclear executive, Arnie Gunderson of Fairwinds Associates, makes a strong case there are intermittent bursts of criticality, live and uncontrolled atomic reactions happening in reactor number one. He bases this on isotopes reported by Japanese authorities, which can only come from a current atomic reaction, and which may erupt from time to time inside the damaged reactor. Find a link to his video in my blog at ecoshock.info. Reactor number two is estimated to be 30% destroyed, and several sources say melted radioactive materials have burned through the containment to the concrete floor below. Extremely radioactive water has filled the turbine hall and trenches around that reactor, including that 7,000 tons an hour leak into the Pacific Ocean. Reactor number three looks all but destroyed from the aerial footage and has radioactive water so hot workers cannot even try to restore systems there. The spent fuel pool in reactor four was out of water for some time, may have damaged fuel rods, and could be the most dangerous of all. So you can see why all this has practically dropped out of the mainstream news. Let's get back to that intentional dumping of radioactive water by TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company. Here's an announcement from NHK World Japanese TV.
The operator of the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant has begun discharging contaminated water into the ocean. The radiation level of the released water is said to be very low. Tokyo Electric Power Company says it needs to free up space to store water with much higher levels of radiation. Contaminated water being discharged from two sources. One is a waste processing facility holding 10,000 tons of water. The other is a pit underneath number 5 and number 6 reactors that contains 1,500 tons of contaminated runoff. TEPCO stresses that contamination of seawater will be very low. It says the amount of radiation a grown-up will receive in a year by eating fish and seaweed is calculated to be 0.6 millisievert. Now, this is lower than the government's 1 millisievert safety standard.
We have decided that discharging the contaminated water into sea poses no major health hazard and that it is unavoidable in order to avoid bigger risks.
Even before this dumping, radioactive fish were found off the coast of Japan. Again, NHK World on April 4th.
Small fish caught in the waters off Ibaraki Prefecture have been found to contain radioactive cesium at levels above the government-mandated safety limit. Ibaraki lies to the south of the Fukushima Prefecture, site of a damaged Fukushima Daiichi nuclear power plant. Officials in Ibaraki say the fish, called a sand lance, contain 526 becquerels of radioactive cesium per kilogram. The acceptable limit is 500 becquerels. This is the first time that higher than permitted levels of radioactive cesium have been found in fish. All local fishery cooperatives in the prefecture have agreed to suspend fishing of sand lances at the request of the prefectural government.
If the contaminated water keeps leaking, it'll gradually ruin the sea. What we hope is one thing: stop the leak.
Later, we'll try to squeeze in the controversy about safety standards and how some governments are withdrawing their monitoring programs already. But before we go to our first guest, you should hear this conversation about radioactive materials contaminating people with sea spray. This was recorded well before Fukushima by WMRW Vermont Radio in the program Politics and Science, March 30th, 2010.
I went over to Ireland to talk about Sellafield. We have a reprocessing plant here on the Irish Sea, which dumps all its radiation into the Irish Sea. And there was a court case being brought by some people in Ireland against England, because Ireland doesn't have any nuclear power, you know. So it was concerned that it might be receiving effects from Sellafield. So I got a job working as a project, which I set up to look at health effects of people living near the Irish Sea. And I found that people living near the Irish Sea had about a 40% increased risk of cancer if they lived within 800 meters of the sea. And we found that we could explain that on the basis of measurements that were made of plutonium that was brought ashore by sea spray. And incidentally, this effect also occurs in America, because I've done some work on data that Joe Mangano gave me on Millstone, the Millstone reactor in New England, where is it, Connecticut. That shows the same sort of effect. You know, you get high levels of leukemia near the coast because of this exposure to salt spray containing the radioactive substances which get dumped into the sea. And Millstone is a really dirty reactor. It dumps all this stuff into the sea.
So you're saying that that spray produces something that you actually ingest?
You inhale it. You don't ingest it, no.
Oh, I see.
Ingestion isn't too bad, incidentally. What we've discovered is that the transfer coefficients for these substances from ingestion are not very great. It's inhalation that's the problem. They go up the nose and into the lung, and then straight through into the lymphatic system, and then into the bloodstream, just like that. The reason we know this is because there have been measurements made in this country of people living near the sea. So, you know, this is not just like some crazy theory. We measured the plutonium near the sea, and then there were measurements made that were published of the autopsies, you know, the corpses. So people who died, they got, I think, 400 or 500 people, and they cut them up and looked inside their chests and found the plutonium. So you've got much more plutonium if you live near the sea than if you live inland.
And that's only if you live near a reprocessing plant? Is that a recycling, nuclear recycling?
It's a reprocessing plant.
I see.
Sure.
So that's what they're trying to sell here in the United States now. The nuclear power industry is in a big push to sell us new reactors, and recycling is the panacea they're selling.
How strangely this risk now applies to the coastal residents of Japan, and perhaps soon to people on the American Pacific coast as well? The speaker is Chris Busby, a chemist who specializes in cases of so-called low-level nuclear exposure. As the Japanese government and utility keep dumping radioactive waste into the Pacific, over the coming months, we may all face this new risk. And Japanese officials have already announced it will take many months just to clear the reactor buildings of contaminated water while trying to develop an alternative self-contained cooling system. We have an ongoing radioactive poisoning of the sea imposed by one nation on all nations and all species. German television quotes Greenpeace atomic scientist Carsten Spitz saying, "Currents will carry the contaminated water towards Canada, from where it will reach Germany by entering the food chain through fish." Here's the quick German version.
Das wird zunächst einmal eine unmittelbare Bedrohung auch für den gesamten Küstenstreifen darstellen. Ansonsten wird es aber durch die Strömung auch Richtung Kanada verfrachtet und dort auch von Fischen über die Nahrungskette dann wieder zu uns kommen.
Okay, let's go to our interview with a longtime expert on nuclear affairs, Dr. John Large in Britain. His phone has been filled with interviews since this disaster began. Our guest is Dr. John Large, longtime nuclear consultant, now with his own company at Large & Associates. John, how reliable do you think government information from Japan on the radiation escapes, how accurate do you think these are now?
It's pretty confused, actually. I mean, what one would expect, and you have to take into account that Japan has been through a national calamity of an earthquake and tsunami, and on top of that has had bolted on this quite serious nuclear incident. You expect in a nuclear incident that because of the public perception of all things nuclear, a fate worse than death, and remember the Japanese have got a collective memory of radiation through Hiroshima and Nagasaki, you expect the public perception to overreact, and then government in the first one or two days tends to compensate, overcompensate by giving too many assurances, underrating the incident, things like that. But what we've seen here is that expected response for the first two or three days, but then a continuing response of bewilderment sometimes, public arguments between TEPCO, the Tokyo Electric Power Company, and the government spokesman, denials that the pressure vessels of the reactors have collapsed or have fouled, and so on and so forth. And now with the latest incident, the rather sort of wrangled argument about the discharge of 11,000 tons of contaminated water, all seems rather confusing, if not a bit disingenuous.
And right here on the West Coast, we find that scientists at UC Berkeley have released test data showing rainwater in California 181 times the legal limit for iodine-131 in drinking water there. Is that significant?
Of course it is, because, first of all, I have to say that it's up to the individual member of public to consider how concerned he or she may be. And it's not up for scientists in white coats to make that decision for them, for those individuals. The point here is that any increase of radiation uptake is accompanied by an increase in the risk of some health detriment during the remainder of your lifetime. And that is the law of the effect. That is the recommendations of the International Commission on Radiological Protection, an international body serviced by all of the various governments and their experts. So that is what the International Commission says. An increase in radiation dose exposure has a proportionate increase in risk. So any exposure over and above natural background is an increase of risk. Whether that risk is an acceptable risk to individual members of the public is up for those individuals to make up their own mind.
Now, John Large, here's something I really don't understand. All of the reports we have are for short-lived radioactive iodine, or, well, cesium-137 is not so short-lived, but we have nothing about the heavier, more dangerous elements like plutonium other than one sample done right at the plant. Is it possible or likely only the shorter-lived isotopes are escaping while the worst elements are somehow staying within the plant itself?
Not really. I mean, normally you trace the reason iodine is flagged up fairly quickly is because it has a virtually immediate respiratory effect because it's a gas and because the body sweeps it up and reconcentrates it in the iodine, and because there's a prolactic measure you can take, stable iodate tablets. It means that it's one of those first ones you detect. It's also relatively easy to detect, and it's one of the fastest racehorses out of the trap, so to speak, when you have an accident. Generally, what you find is that iodine and cesium has a half-life of over 30 years, so it's good for about 300 years. But generally, these are taken as trace elements, indicators of what is out or what is to come. Sometimes in accidents, you get very high-temperature accidents that can release specific radionuclides into the environment faster than the others or in greater proportions. But this one, Fukushima, seems to be a series of events where one would expect the whole canopy of the radioactive menu recipe to come out fairly in straight order. So, yes, it's not to be confused. They're only mentioned in one or two. Those are the tracers that you see the rest of the pack coming around the bend after them.
Right, so we might find cobalt or we might find plutonium. Can that be carried?
Cobalt's an activation product. What you're really interested in, the ones you're interested in are the isotopes that have relatively long-term exposures, which are particularly environmentally transport and migrate for the environment, and those that are volatile. And of course, those that have very serious effects on health. Plutonium is one of those. The interesting thing, why plutonium is so important in this particular accident, above all others, is one of the reactors, Reactor 3, was actually fueled with an experimental or trial mix of plutonium-based fuel, MOX fuel. And plutonium has a very, compared to low-enriched uranium, which the other reactors were all fueled with, plutonium has a very harsh radiological footprint. It's particularly important in a plutonium release to actually evacuate public very quickly to stop respiratory uptake. Once plutonium is in the body, taken in the body under the respiratory intake pathway, then it's virtually impossible to shift it. And of course, it deposits, it reconcentrates on skeletal bone surfaces, in genitals and things like that. So it's a very potent radioisotope.
Both TEPCO and the U.S. Energy Secretary Stephen Chu have reported severe damage at reactor number 1, up to 70%, Stephen Chu says, and about 33% damage to reactor number 2. Which of these reactors do you think are posing the greatest public menace at this time?
Well, I would say the one that's really concerning is not a reactor, but the fuel pond of Unit 4. The reactor at Unit 4 was actually defueled. It was undergoing some form of inspection, and they'd taken the fuel out, about 95 tons of fuel, and had placed it in the fuel pond, which is immediately adjacent to the reactor charging cap, on top of those cube-like buildings. And so in that fuel pond, not only did you have a fresh, hot reactor core unloaded, 95 tons, there were effectively another two complete cores in the reactor. There was about nearly 300 tons of fuel in that reactor. We don't know what happened to it. Very clearly, the water cooling the fuel, because spent nuclear fuel emits heat by virtue of radioactive decay alone, it needs water to cool it. It seems that it either went through a zirconium steam reaction or some sort of criticality event, what you need, if the water boils down in the pond, these fuel ponds are all like large swimming pools, deep swimming pools, with a fuel under about 7 meters of water. And they're emitting heat. So if you lose all cooling services, then over a matter of days, the water will heat up, then it will go through its boil phase, and the water level will drop off quite rapidly. If the fuel becomes uncovered, then the residual, the steamy atmosphere left in the bottom of the pool and in between the racks that hold the irradiated fuel, you can get very high temperatures, maybe 1,000 degrees, 1,200 degrees C, that sort of regime. And at that temperature, the zirconium cladding, this rare earth metal cladding, will violently react with the steam. The zirconium wants to go rusty. We're not really worried about the zirconium rust, but of course, in doing that, it grabs the oxygen out the steam and leaves the hydrogen free. For about every kilogram of zirconium, you can produce about a half cubic meter of hydrogen. And that becomes a source. That can become the source of an explosion. There's no doubt that a zirconium steam reaction occurred at unit number 1, the reactor, and also on the reactor number 3. And we saw them trying to vent the reactor, take the hydrogen off of the reactor, and we saw the hydrogen explosion occur outside the reactor in the charge hall. This one, fuel pond number 4, we're not sure. It's not sure whether it went through a hydrogen deflagration or whether it was a criticality incident. A criticality incident is when the fuel gets very hot. The water's boiled down. The fuel gets very hot. The pins of the fuel assemblies begin to bow and move towards each other. The zirconium, very fine cladding of the tubes, unzips itself. The situation gets into a critical mass and then flashes off in a critical reaction, giving a burst of neutrons and an enormous explosive force. Not a nuclear explosion, but a very energetic pulse. That was sufficient, I believe, to actually blow the top of the charge hall to pieces. And if you look at the photographs that have been taken by remote drones flying around, you can see that the pond is empty of water, the fuel racks are overturned, the fuel is sprayed all around the place. And, of course, the problem there is a continuing release of radioactivity into the atmosphere until that situation can be confined and addressed. You can't simply build a cover over it. You still have to provide cooling for the fuel. And that may well go on for several months, if not years.
I have news reports that the Environmental Protection Agency in the United States is planning on raising its safety limits for cesium in food, and that the EU has already done so with a directive without much public consultation. Have you heard that, and why raise safety limits at such a critical time?
Well, I think what's happening is that there's a greater awareness, particularly if you had an accident in the field, there's a greater awareness of the potential for the public to react. In many ways, one, I don't want to sound too callous here or cynical, but it may be that the regulators think that taking an action like this will somehow placate the public, to reassure the public. What is happening in the nuclear industry and the regulatory authorities, the NRC in the States, the Nuclear Installations Inspectorate in the UK, these are part of the nuclear industry, and they sometimes become very defensive of the nuclear industry and will try and assure the public to try and, if you like, redress that public perception. They will try and assure the public by taking these actions. At the moment, these are meaningless actions so far as we in the UK and Western Europe are concerned and in the United States, because there would not be expected to be a massive radioactive fallout from the Fukushima plant. On the west coast of the United States, obviously you're going to get whispers of iodine in the upper atmosphere. That's going to come down. And as I said, it's not for me to actually say what the level of concern should be for the public, but the risk levels will be relatively low. So I think the actions of the regulators is probably just is a matter of politics.
And as we wrap up, what other important news have you heard that you think our listeners should know?
Well, what is happening now is that the TEPCO and the regulatory authority in Japan seem to now be agreeing to actually discharge about 11,500 tons of contaminated water into the marine environment. This is a serious change. The TEPCO are arguing that to keep the reactors cool, they need to now free up space volume to hold the contaminated water. What is happening is they're spraying water willy-nilly, quite frankly, around these reactors, into the reactors, and with the exposed fuel, then that water is becoming heavily contaminated. The water outside number two reactor, which is filling up a trench, this trench holds about 700 to 800 tons of water and is connected to a series of tunnels and basements in the turbine hall, so maybe about 3,000 cubic meters or tons in all. The surface radiation dose levels of that water are about 1,000 millisieverts per hour. 1,000 units of radiation per hour. Well, you know, a member of the public in Europe, in the United States, in Canada, would have a maximum annual limit of exposure of 1 millisievert from external sources. So we're talking about surface of water that's emitting 1,000 times the annual radiation dose receipt of any member of the public. TEPCO say that this has to be moved into safe and secure storage. For that, it's going to dump the 11,000 or so cubic meters it seems to have in storage of not-so-radioactive water. Well, it's not a very convincing argument, they put, that they're going to all the trouble to dump 11,000 tons of not-so-radioactive water so they can store some more radioactive water. Because what will happen is this. In another 2 or 3 weeks' time, because they've got to continue spraying down the reactors, injecting fresh water into the reactors to keep them cool, they will have another 11,000 tons or so of water. Are they then going to put that into tanks and then discharge the 11,000 tons of water they put in the tanks today or tomorrow? So it looks like a pretty grim situation for the marine environment. In fact, a disaster for the marine environment.
Yes, they're going to have to keep spraying and pumping and putting water into this for months, if not years, according to the reports I'm getting.
Well, I would certainly say months. The reactors themselves, what you can do with a reactor, once you turn a reactor off, then the heat generation by radioactive decay alone, not by any nuclear process, just by the radioactive decay of particularly the short-lived isotopes. The short-lived isotopes dominate for about 6 to 8 weeks, thereabouts. That means you have to have quite intense cooling mechanisms to stop the fuel overheating. The problem becomes that decay is an exponential decay of heat generation, but it stabilizes out when you do still need a fairly high heat load to actually keep the fuel cool. And that will go on for years, if not decades. So the problem for the Japanese now is to somehow try and get those reactors, 1, 2, and 3, and particularly that fuel pond in 4, and possibly the fuel ponds in reactors 1, 2, and 3 as well, is to get those into a contained situation where they can contain water and the water can be treated for heat removal by a heat transfer system and maybe some radiological abatement system to actually remove the radioactivity. The problem is, because of the damage, particularly to 1 and reactor 3 and certainly fuel pond 4, it seems it will be very, very difficult, a remarkable challenge, technical and radiological challenge, to actually fit that wreckage with any ordered system of heat removal and radiation abatement.
Dr. John Large, do you have a website where people who want to learn more about you can go?
Well, they can go to largeandassociates.com if they want to visit the sort of Armageddon and doom and gloom world we live in.
Perfect. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith reporting. Thank you so much, sir.
Thank you.
You are listening to Radio EcoShock as we plumb the depths of nuclear disaster in Japan. I'm Alex Smith. In our next segment, we will ask, what is safe and will the government tell us?
Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. Let us learn from the Asian experience of when nukes go wrong. It isn't that much different from Three Mile Island or Chernobyl, what really happens. When it comes to government information to the bruised people of Japan, that doesn't come in time to help the survivors. After the first week of this disaster, the IAEA and the United States government pleaded for more information from the utility TEPCO and from the Japanese government. Starting March 19th, the Americans evacuated 200,000 personnel and their dependents in a mass air transit job. A government website gives the reason, quote, "Departure is authorized due to the deteriorating situation at the Fukushima Daiichi nuclear plant following the 8.8 earthquake and tsunami," end quote. Almost a month later, we still find the Japanese government withholding information vital to the health and safety of citizens. Yomiuri Press complains, quote, "The Meteorological Agency has been withholding forecasts on dispersal of radioactive substances from the Fukushima No. 1 reactor power plant, despite making the forecast every day. It was learned Monday." Here is NHK World TV from Japan, April 3rd.
Japan's government says it will withheld computer projections indicating high levels of radioactivity in areas more than 30 kilometers from the troubled Fukushima Daiichi power plant due to inaccurate data. An institute commissioned by the government made the estimates using a computer system called SPEEDY on March 16th after explosions at the plant. The system estimated that people who remained outdoors for 24 hours in Itate village, some 40 kilometers from the plant, would be exposed to radiation exceeding 100 millisieverts. The projections were based on the assumption that radioactive substances had been released for 24 hours on March 15th. The government's Nuclear Safety Commission says it did not release the projections because the locations or amount of radioactive leakage was not specified at the time.
The trend towards keeping the numbers down and the people pacified, if uninformed, runs at local governments as well. Ibaraki Prefecture, just south of Fukushima, has been heavily irradiated. In the city of Ushiku, the local government did not tell residents when radioactive iodine topped the 100 becquerel per liter safety limits, reaching 124.9 on March 24th.
The Japanese Science and Technology Ministry says a cumulative radiation dose in Namie town topped 10 millisieverts in the 11-day period to Sunday. Namie is a little more than 30 kilometers from Fukushima Daiichi. Now, 10 millisieverts is the limit set by the government before ordering residents to stay indoors. The Nuclear Safety Commission said the limit has only been exceeded in a small area. It maintains the zone where residents should seek shelter inside doesn't need to be expanded.
Professor Masaharu Hoshi of Hiroshima University's Research Institute for Radiation Biology and Medicine says it's problematic that the state has not given an explanation to residents when the dose exceeds the state's target figure. He says the target figure is one criteria, so the government must decide what to do according to specific situations, but it must fulfill its responsibility to give an adequate explanation to residents. Chief Cabinet Secretary Yukio Edano says the government will wait for the results of the review of the evacuation zone and the indoor shelter zone before acting upon today's findings.
The Ministry of Education has touted their real-time radiation listings from the Nuclear Safety Division. I've checked that daily, and the most irradiated prefectures of Fukushima and nearby Miyagi are never listed. They always just say, under survey. The worst information is not released. A series of independent tests by Greenpeace radiologists and by representatives for the International Atomic Energy Agency have shown unsafe radiation in towns and cities well beyond the current evacuation zone, like cesium-137 40 kilometers away in Iatate Village and even up to 200 kilometers away. In some cases, the residents were not told to stay inside for their safety. The IAEA and the United States are pleading with the Japanese government to expand the evacuation zone to include another 170,000 people, but so far without result.
We're operating almost totally in the blind. Is that information is anecdotal? The mine is non-existent. I don't know, a couple of blind men now have to stagger on making decisions.
The Japanese press do not use investigative reporting. Their traditional role is to repeat and explain what authorities like the government and the utility company TEPCO say at press briefings. Period. I have known Japanese NGOs who plead for information to be published in American newspapers like the New York Times. Then and only then the Japanese press will repeat what the foreign press said. There is hardly any way to originate a story in Japan beyond what authority says.
Less than 200 kilometers to the north lies Japan's capital, where the operator of the crippled Fukushima plant is coming under increasing pressure. A small crowd gathered outside the headquarters of the Tokyo Electric Power Company to voice their anger at its handling of the crisis. The protests seemed to go completely unnoticed by the Japanese media, but across the road there were plenty of other plain-clothed bystanders. They watched and filmed whoever turned up, but were camera shy themselves. The Japanese journalists could be found inside the TEPCO building, waiting for the latest update from management. One reporter who wasn't there was Takashi Uesugi. He's a freelancer who's now out of work after he criticized TEPCO for mistakes made after the tsunami struck.
The Japanese mass media is basically sponsored by TEPCO through advertising. So far, nobody from the mass media has criticized TEPCO, only freelancers.
Wayne Hay, Al Jazeera, Hamaoka, Japan.
Advertisers controlling the press? Well, that could never happen here. And the nuclear industry rolls on, pushing even now for more and more reactors. The CEO of General Electric, Jeffrey Imhelt, Obama's advisor on how to send jobs overseas without ever paying taxes, was in Japan to boost confidence in the blown-up reactors his companies designed and helped build. At least, unlike poor muddle-headed George Monbiot, the Japanese media understands the role of the International Atomic Energy Agency. It's to sell more nuclear power, not to regulate it.
The head of the International Atomic Energy Agency says it'll do its utmost to restore public trust in the safety of nuclear energy. The Convention on Nuclear Safety gathers once every 3 years with its 72 member nations and institutions. Director General Yukio Amano suggested the accident at the Fukushima Daiichi plant could affect the UN nuclear watchdog's future activities. The IAEA has been promoting nuclear power.
The situation at Fukushima Daiichi remains very serious. The worries of millions of people throughout the world about whether nuclear energy is safe must be taken seriously.
Amano expressed his determination to restore public trust through steps that include ministerial talks in June. The Japanese government and the IAEA will hold a special joint seminar during the meeting, which will run through April 14th. Officials of Japan's Nuclear and Industrial Safety Agency will also give a briefing on the latest details of the Fukushima situation.
and Russia, where AFP reports Fukushima radioactive particles were detected in Moscow on April 1st, and where the far eastern seaboard around Vladivostok may get both wind and ocean-borne radioactivity, Russia is still out there selling nuclear power plants to any buyer, anywhere. Here's an update from NHK World on the Russian reactor market.
In April 1984, the world's worst ever nuclear accident took place at the Chernobyl nuclear power plant in the Ukraine, then part of the Soviet Union. The disaster prompted the Soviet government to cancel plans to build more nuclear plants. But when Vladimir Putin became president of Russia in 2000, he made a major policy shift and began promoting nuclear energy to meet the needs of the country's rapidly growing economy. It was a low-cost power generation solution for Russia, which has easy access to uranium sourced domestically and from other countries of the former Soviet Union.
As people's standard of living improves, there's growing demand for electricity. We have to provide more electricity not only during the winter, when we have to use heaters, but also in summer, because more and more people now have air conditioners in their homes.
The Russian government sees atomic power as a key to its economic growth and is promoting nuclear technology exports. In the past 10 years, Russia has won contracts in five countries, including China and India, to build a total of 13 nuclear plants and provide them with fuel. Nuclear energy is one of the few industries where Russia has a competitive edge in the global market. 4 days after the accident in Fukushima, Putin, now Russia's prime minister, visited Belarus and agreed to help that country build new nuclear power plants. Then on March 16th, Russian President Dmitry Medvedev met Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan in Moscow and promised that Russia will continue to help Turkey with its nuclear power development program. Russia has made it clear that it will continue to push hard to win contracts for building nuclear plants abroad, while keeping an eye on how the events at Fukushima affect the rest of the world.
Australia's green economist Ross Garnaut says nuclear is still the way to go, at least for valuable uranium exports for that country. The whole nuclear military-industrial complex, with all the talking heads of state, are whirling around the world reassuring everyone. French President Nicolas Sarkozy went straight to Japan. Obama still wants $36 billion for the nuclear industry. Now we see who these politicians really work for. And strangely, the machines and regulations that monitor and protect the population are being pulled back, even in this time of atomic emergency. Early press reports said the American Environmental Protection Agency withdrew 20 monitors because readings were too high. The agency later clarified that these radiation monitors, part of RadNet, weren't working properly. That included 4 out of 11 monitoring machines in California, where 2 nuclear power plants sit near earthquake faults. In fact, the federal government didn't release any radioactivity report until Tuesday, April 5th, 25 days after one of the world's largest nuclear disasters. That's some early warning system. We only found out there was radiation landing in the U.S. Northeast because it was reported by a nuclear power plant operator. The University of California, Berkeley in San Francisco reported rainwater testing many times the safe level of iodine-131 during heavy rains on March 23rd. The site has now been retrofitted, saying rainwater doesn't count, only tap water should be considered, and that was safe. Let's talk with another university that measured Fukushima radiation on the West Coast.
Radio EcoShock.
Our guest now is Christoph Starosta, known as Chris, I guess, an associate professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Chris, how did Simon Fraser University find emissions from the Fukushima disaster?
So after we learned about the Fukushima accident, we decided to set up a monitoring system for the rainwater. So we set up a collecting station where we collected water whenever it was raining. And we have at Simon Fraser a germanium detector in the lead shield for environmental studies. So that was the tool which we used to identify gamma rays from the emission of emitted after the decay of radioiodine, the isotope of iodine called iodine-131. This is a man-made isotope. It does not exist in the atmosphere under normal conditions. It has a half-life of 8 days. So whenever you have a release within a couple of weeks, iodine-131 decays completely and it's absent from the atmosphere. So we started to monitor the rainwater and search for the signature of iodine-131, and we didn't see anything until March 18th, and then on March 19th and on March 20th, we've seen a spike, which indicated the presence of iodine-131. And then we decided to verify these findings with by examining other samples. And we knew that seaweed is a marine plant which accumulates iodine. So we decided to monitor also seaweed. And we've seen the same signal in the seaweed. And we collected seaweed from two different places, from Vancouver Island and from North Vancouver. So rainwater and seaweed from both places showed a consistent signal associated with the presence of iodine-131. So we concluded that this must be a release from Fukushima.
Now, the city of Vancouver draws on water from open reservoirs, and we presume rainwater would go in there. Is there any risk currently to the drinking water for the city?
I don't think so. We have been monitoring the content of iodine-131 in the rainwater whenever we had a possibility to collect samples. There were a couple of clear days where we were not able to collect the rainwater, but we've seen, I described the increase on the March 19th and 20th. We've seen plateau after that, which extended until March 25th. And then starting from March 25th, we've seen a decline in the rate of iodine-131. And as of yesterday, our samples show essentially no presence in iodine-131 in the rainwater. And even the amounts which we have seen in the rainwater were really tiny. We've seen amounts of 12 becquerels per liter. 12 becquerels means 12 decays per second per liter of water. And if you take into account the fact that the water, rainwater with containing iodine-131 would be diluted in the reservoirs which were holding water before Fukushima, the amount which would end up in the drinking water is really tiny.
And that's what I've heard from Environment Canada as well. So far, there's no reason to panic about that. But do we have a way of measuring, for example, the cesium-137 that might be arriving?
We are sensitive to cesium-137. So cesium-137 has a gamma ray, which we could see. I think that the answer to that is that the first thing you would see is iodine-131, and that's the reason we observe iodine-131. And the reason is that cesium-137 has much longer lifetime and is much harder to detect. It requires longer measurements. On the other hand, iodine-131 has shorter lifetimes. It's more active, and it decays more. Therefore, it's easier to spot it. And cesium and iodine would be released into atmospheric releases. Both, I think, will go together. So the first thing to watch for, I think, is iodine-131. We are saving the samples. So the samples which we collected are saved. And we are going to look for cesium-137 when the things are going to calm down and we have more time to spend on prolonged measurements. So the samples which we are saving right now will preserve cesium-137, so we'll be able to go back in time and assess the levels of cesium-137.
And the reason I asked about that is because it is a longer-lasting radiative material and so perhaps more serious if it is arriving, and I guess the answer is we don't know yet.
I wouldn't. Yeah, I mean, the question is, of course, what we don't know is we don't know the quantities. And I think that probably the people who measure with, let's say, can have more detectors to measure different kinds of radioactivity simultaneously, they probably know. We at Simon Fraser, we don't know it because we have only one measuring station and we have to manage the measurements with single measuring station. So if we measure iodine-131, we cannot measure cesium-137, essentially, because we cannot afford the time to do these measurements. But I think that there are other governmental agencies which are not limited in this way, and they can. I think that I will be careful in concluding that we don't know. I think that it's probably known, and it certainly can be assessed in the future from the measurements of the samples which were preserved.
Well, I guess the thing that concerns me is that we haven't had a report from the Canadian government that I'm aware of whether cesium-137 is arriving here or not. I just haven't seen any reporting on it.
Oh, I haven't seen them either, but that's probably because I didn't look carefully enough. But I think that I can tell you that in our measurements, which are targeted towards iodine-131, we don't see an increase of cesium-137. And one thing about cesium-137, which we need to remember, is that there were on the order of 2,000 atmospheric tests of nuclear weapon before the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty was signed. And cesium-137 has been emitted from, there was probably on the order of 550 atmospheric tests. And the cesium-137, which was dispersed from these tests in the 60s and 50s and 60s, is still around us because of the fact that it has 30 years lifetime. So we actually do see cesium-137 in our spectra, in our measurement, and I can measure the intensity of cesium-137. So I should maybe be more precise. I don't see any changes in the cesium-137. I do see cesium-137, but the fact that it's not changing is, for me, indicative that this is a cesium-137 which is not related to Fukushima. It's the constant cesium-137 which is present in the atmosphere from the previous releases, for example, nuclear weapon tests.
Thank you. I find that a good explanation. There's one other thing, if you could help me with this, and if you can't, just go ahead and say so, but there's a fellow named Chris Busby in the United Kingdom who has been critical of the ICRP model, which he says measures full body exposure to external emissions, whereas what we need to be concerned about is internal inhalation or ingestion of radioactive particles. Or certainly that's what the Japanese need to be concerned about. Have you heard about this controversy, and are you comfortable with the safety measures set by the authorities so far?
Well, I think I'm certainly aware of the controversy because it's a well-known controversy, and I think that the difficulty in dealing with the situations like that is that there are no good data on the low-level exposures. So we are talking right now about exposure to low levels of radioactivity. If in this situation, it is very difficult to assess the impact of the radioactivity or disentangle the impact of the radioactivity of other sources which can contribute, for example, to the increased chance of cancer, right? So if somebody is smoking cigarettes and inhaling radioactivity, it's difficult to assess what is the impact of one in the presence or absence of the other because the low exposures inherently have a difficulty in being quantified. I think that, having said that, I'm not a doctor. I don't have a degree in medicine, and I haven't studied that. We measure radiation, and we report simply the radiation levels. I think that with the risk assessment, you need to be always careful because you can actually taking preventive measures against imaginary risk, you can actually do more harm than good. And one way to compare is compare the situation which we have right now is to compare to other incidents. And there is data available on other incidents. So, for example, when we were doing our studies here in the rainwater, we looked up the literature, and we've seen papers coming from Japan, from Nagoya, Japan, in 1988, where people were studying the levels of iodine-131 in the rainwater following the Chernobyl explosion. And this were iodine-131, which was showing up in Nagoya, Japan, after the Chernobyl, and they were reporting levels four times higher than we have seen in the rainwater. So as we were reporting 10 becquerels or 11, 12 becquerels per liter, they were showing 40, 44 and more. And this study, which is published in a medical journal, Health Physics, it actually concluded that there was no impact on the population. This is one of our reference points. I think that this controversy is not going to be resolved anytime soon. I think the reason is that there is no data, essentially. I think that if you ask me about my comment on that, I would say that we always need to compare to the levels of the background in which we live, the environmental background levels. And we as humans were evolving in the presence of radiation. Radiation was always around us, and radiation is going to stay with us. There are sources, natural sources of radiation, which is crust of the Earth and a cosmic background, and these sources of radiation are always with us. And when we talk about the levels of exposures which are small, comparable to the natural doses which we receive, if there was really a harm of these small doses, it would probably lead to an extinction of our human race long time
ago. But I have to say, as you've pointed out, Dr. Starosta, that the atomic testing did introduce new types of elements onto the Earth that had never existed before during our evolution and raised the level of radioactivity. And here we have another situation where it appears like we're going to be adding more radioactivity than the background would have been there during our evolution. I think we've got to wrap up now. Is there any closing comments you'd like to make?
Yeah, I think I would say that if you measure these quantities of man-made elements compared to other, they're small.
Very good. Thank you for your opinion. And this is Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock. We've been talking with Chris Starosta, the associate professor at Simon Fraser University in Canada. Thank you. As one contributor to theoildrum.com noted, it's like the nuclear information lights are going out all over the world. Canada's Natural Resources Agency has put the following on its reporting webpage, quote, "Please note that as of March 25, 2011, the frequency of data collection by the NRC-CAN using the mobile surveys has been decreased due to the low levels of radiation being detected. The surveys will be repeated periodically and the data table will be updated," end quote. And both the US EPA and the European Union are currently moving the safe level of radiation upwards as Fukushima rages out of control. The EPA Protective Action Guides, or PAGs, have been revised upwards for iodine-131 and other radioactive materials, allowing thousands of times more. The group Public Employees for Environmental Responsibility, or PEER, has exposed these changes. In Europe, a series of foreign language sources report the European Union has quietly, without public input, raised the permissible levels on a number of radioactive substances in an emergency ordinance number 297/2011 on March 27th. This includes allowing higher radioactivity in foods and herbal products just in time for the new round of radiation. Isn't the government supposed to protect us? Nuclear critics like Chris Busby and Helen Caldicott and some nuclear scientists have been saying the allowable limits for safety are a cruel joke anyway. The whole regime of what is supposedly safe exposure was based on a physics calculation where external radiation is measured as a full-body dose, considering the human body like a big sack of water. Listen to a full explanation by Chris Busby in the Politics and Science podcast, as posted April 2nd on www.radioforall.net. That's radio, the number for all.net, or find that link in my blog. In fact, that program, Politics and Science, has a whole list of essential nuclear listening shows on low-level radiation. Like Dr. Starosta, not all scientists agree with Busby's assessment, but it makes sense to me. Check the sources and decide for yourself. In fact, as you heard in our Radio EcoShock interview with Dr. Caldicott 2 weeks ago, the real threat comes from radioactive particles that are inhaled or eaten with food. Be sure and listen to Helen Caldicott's weekly radio show, If You Love This Planet, at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. This week, she has a special Fukushima update, and that will likely continue in coming programs. Once lodged in the body, particles like plutonium and other radioactive heavy metals impact the DNA in just a small part of the body very intensely. The damage ricochets into cancer and other diseases brought on by damaged chromosomes. Detailed studies of cancers and other diseases near nuclear power plants and following famous nuclear accidents, not to mention the atomic testing downwinders and those poor people in Iraq who suffer from spent uranium weapons, all show that particles within the body bring on disease at levels many times lower and many times greater than the published safety limits would tell you. Those were derived in the 1950s before DNA was even discovered. We stick with the outdated science at our peril and as a convenience for both the nuclear power industry and the governments who support them. If we, the public, learn only one thing from this Fukushima accident, it must be the need for new and fair regulations governing doses of radiation at low levels and the cumulative dose, and that, says Chris Busby, would mean a speedy end to the nuclear power industry. Look and learn for yourself. The authorities will not warn or protect you in time. That is the true and sad lesson taught by both climate change and nuclear technology. Fukushima is the schoolhouse, and a harsh one, for Japan, for us all. I'm Alex Smith. Our show blog is at ecoshock.info. The main website is ecoshock.org. Find us on 25 college and community radio stations, by podcast, and live by satellite. Thank you for hanging in through this awful time, and join us next week for Radio EcoShock. And thanks to all the listeners from all over the world who sent in those hot tips and links about this nuclear story. Couldn't do it without you. Keep them coming. Radio@ecoshock.org.